Good morning, everyone. We're ready to begin with the first case of the day, United States versus Jones. And Mr. Friesen, did I pronounce that correctly? Friesen.
Good morning, Justices, Mr. Blackington, fellow counsel.
And Mr. Friesen, we're judges.
We're not
justices. Only the Illinois Appellate and Supreme Court and our U.S. Supreme Court.
Use my ear.
It's all right.
My name is Ronald Friesen. I'm here for Brian Jones, and I am here to argue Appellant's Issue 9 today, which deals with the verdict form in this case. This case was initiated by indictment in the Southern District of Indiana. Superseding indictment was later filed, and the six appellants went to trial on that superseding indictment. The jury returned verdicts of guilty as to all the defendants on count one, which was conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute a controlled substance, and also returned guilty verdicts on counts 2, 3, 4, and 6, which are distribution of controlled substances as to Mr. Simmons, and count 5, distribution of controlled substances as to Mr. McGee. After that, the court sentenced the defendants, all defendants receiving a life sentence with the exception of Mr. Cook, and his sentence was 257 months imprisonment.
And since your only issue is this whole separate verdict form question, could you just tell us or explain why you think U.S. versus Seymour doesn't apply, why your argument isn't foreclosed by that?
Yes, ma'am.
Because that to me seems to be your most difficult hurdle.
Okay. As my reading of the Seymour case and other related cases, being the Knight case, the issue in those cases what seemed to be whether or not the court had to make or the jury had to make a specific finding of quantity as to each defendant. In addition to that, the court observed that it was clear that all of the defendants in those cases possessed and had to do with a quantity substantially more than the 5 kilograms of powder or 50 grams of crack cocaine. In this case, it's not so clear that the defendants had that. The other issue, and the main issue that I'm raising, is not so much quantity, but what is the agreement? The agreement is the conspiracy. And in this case that we have, it's felt that there are can be multiple agreements.
But, well, you did not request a multiple conspiracy instruction, did you?
Well,
it was discussed, I think, wasn't it? And
yes,
there was some explicit decision not to have such instruction.
An argument for the verdict form, and we felt that the verdict form would take care of the issues we had, but if the judge did not grant the verdict form that we requested, we asked for multiple conspiracy instruction. The judge denied our request. And the it's interesting to observe that the government tried all of these defendants together. Our request on the verdict form was that it be the precise verdict form that the government requested, although it would be one for each defendant. That's the kind of verdict form you would have had if these defendants would have been tried separately. And so we weren't asking for a specific quantity. We were asking that they determine the range as to the defendants. For instance, in this conspiracy as to the powder, they found less than 500 grams. Well, the maximum penalty there is 20 years, and if you have one prior, then not more, one prior drug felony conviction, not more than 30 years. So we feel that by having one form, we precluded the jury from being able to determine the maximum penalty as to each one of these defendants. That's the thrust of our argument, as opposed to other cases where they wanted a specific quantity determined.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Foster?
Good morning, all counsel, Mr. Blackington. My name is Mark Foster, and I'm going to be arguing on behalf of Mitchell McGee and also as to the issue of the right to present a defense, Leonard Hoskins, on behalf of Mr. Bolieber, who is not present. At the trial, both Mitchell McGee and Leonard Hoskins attempted to introduce a statement from a co-defendant who had actually pled guilty in the middle of the trial, Lamont Robinson. Mr. Robinson stated during his guilty plea colloquy that when asked, what do you know about Mitchell McGee, his statement was nothing. And Lamont Robinson also said the same as to Leonard Hoskins. What we attempted to do, we called Agent Freiberger, as a witness in our offer to proof, to ask him whether or not Mr. Robinson made these statements.
Had the government introduced evidence that Robinson had dealt directly with either of those two defendants?
They had not introduced evidence that he had dealt directly with them.
So how would it be relevant?
Their theory of while Mr. Robinson was still a defendant, their theory was that he was Mr. Simmons' right-hand man, that he was the delivery person, that he was the enforcer, and that he was with Jeremy Simmons at all times, essentially. And when his statements that he didn't know these two individuals would indicate that they are not part of the conspiracy. They may have been customers, but they were not part of the conspiracy, of the agreement with this individual that's intimately involved with
him. And was his statement that he didn't know those two or that he didn't deliver to those two?
That he didn't know them.
Didn't know them at all.
Right.
But a conspirator, even a high-up conspirator, isn't obligated to know all of the co-conspirators.
Not necessarily. But it was.
So how does that become relevant?
Well, it's exculpatory. If an individual who is intimately involved with an organization doesn't know somebody else that's involved with the organization, that is exculpatory. And it, again, it's just one piece of the puzzle.
But even if you get over that relevance hurdle, the problem here is hearsay. And then if you get over that hurdle, doesn't it open the door to the circumstances under which the plea was taken?
Well, and the co-defendant's objections.
Right.
Well, first of all, as far as the co-defendant's objections, the question that we asked was sanitized. It didn't involve the guilty plea. It didn't involve the time or when it happened. It was sanitized to the extent that he made this statement under oath, and that was it.
Right, and I understand that's what you wanted, but we're talking about what the government would do in response, which is for the jury to evaluate the circumstances and the context in which he made such a statement. That's what the objection of
that
the co-defendants
would prejudice the other defendants. That would be something that the government made the choice when they tried all these cases together. They made a choice that, yes, that could come up, and maybe they couldn't explore that because it would prejudice the other defendants. In reference to the hearsay, there was no hearsay objection at the trial. In fact, it was Mr. Blackington that was arguing with the court that it was not hearsay. When the court said, well, I don't know that he's unavailable, it was Mr. Blackington said, well, I talked to his attorney, and he said, yes, he advised me that he would plead the Fifth if he were called as a witness, and I think he's unavailable. Then the court said, well, I'm not so sure he'd have Fifth Amendment privileges. He's already pled guilty. It was actually Mr. Blackington that argued that, yes, he would because of potential perjury charges. So not only did they waive the argument of hearsay, they were arguing, in fact, against the hearsay. It was Mr. Blackington arguing with the court that it was, in fact, not hearsay. So with that, if I may move on to the motion to suppress and the statement given by Mr. McGee. We had filed a motion to suppress that statement, and it's clear under the record that Mr. McGee was never advised of his Miranda rights.
All right, and we've certainly read the briefs, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Goodridge?
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please support government, fellow counsel? Your Honor, I'm going to be arguing three issues out of the appellant's brief. I represent Jeremy Simmons. He was the lead defendant. He received five life sentences. I would like to deal with the lesser issues first so we can move past those to what I believe is the most substantive issue. The tenth issue in the appellant brief is a challenge to the sentence of life imprisonment for drug offenders. In the government's reply brief, the government states adeptly, at its very core, the appellant's brief is nothing more than an invitation for this court to reconsider and overrule controlling precedent. That is correct. That is what I'm requesting. I wanted to make that record for him, and that's what I'm doing.
We understand.
The other issues that I'll be addressing today are 1A and 1B. I'd like to start with 1B because I consider that a subsidiary issue to the first argument. In 1B, what I'm alleging is, or what I'm arguing is, the government's first application on May 21st, 2007 for the wiretap was premised on certain information the government had possessed, was in possession of, at that time. If there is probable cause for the issuance of that initial wiretap application, I think the court wouldn't have to repeat the analysis for the subsequent applications on Target Phone 2 as well as Target Phone 3. My issue here is that the government did have four controlled buys, I believe. They had multiple controlled buys from Jeremy Simmons, which were obtained through the use of a confidential informant. The confidential informant used consensually recorded phone calls. It wasn't a wiretap. And each of those controlled buys obtained for the government approximately 63 grams of crack cocaine. Based upon that indication and checking the telephone toll registers on what types of phone numbers were being contacted and who was contacting which, the government commingled the Simmons criminal organization with the neighbor's organization without showing any factual nexus between the two organizations, which were in fact two completely separate organizations. Simmons' organization was operating independently in a house a few doors down from the house that the neighbor's organization was operating out of. I believe they started the neighbor's investigation first. And by piggybacking this application with the neighbor's application, I think that helped them exceed the threshold of probable cause. So what I'm asking the court to do is to look independently at the information that the government possessed and the court considered without considering the neighbor's information, which is basically the controlled buys against Jeremy Simmons and the phone toll records.
Well, wasn't there an allegation in that first affidavit that there was a common phone number, that Target Phones 1 and 2 had contact with several common phone numbers, which was the believed link at that point?
There is the allegation that there were common phone numbers between the two.
Between Simmons and neighbors?
I think that the Simmons and neighbors, Target Phone 1 and Target Phone 2, were actually contacting a common phone number.
Right.
But in my recollection of the record is that it didn't reveal that common phone number was a drug distributor. I mean, was it Kmart? Was it Walmart? Was it, you know, just because you're calling the same phone number isn't, I don't think that has probative weight. So I'm asking the court to make an independent determination.
Right.
The most important issue that I think that I raised in the brief, though, on behalf of Mr. Simmons, is 1A. In Issue 1A, what I'm arguing is the government, and it is undisputed in their brief, relied upon an expired order authorizing.
But they had the right guy named, didn't they? Have Keeney named as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General approving the third wiretap, and he, in fact, did approve the third wiretap, right?
Absolutely not disputed.
But they just mentioned an expired delegation of that authority, and the revised delegation of the new one also authorized Deputy Assistant Attorney General to sign those things.
Right? That is absolutely true, not disputed.
Seems so, hyper-technical to me.
Yes. Well, hyper-technical, or is it black-letter law construction and interpretation of a statute? You know, the Title III is clear and unambiguous. It used the word shall. They shall reference the proper...
And they did. Keeney.
The proper assistant. Order number.
Yeah, but wasn't that just a clerical error?
No, actually, it wasn't a clerical error. The government, in their brief, concede that it was an administrative error where, for some reason...
Administrative error.
Yeah. Okay. They dropped the ball.
But the heart of it still doesn't change who authorized it.
That is correct.
The statute doesn't require reference to the correct order, does it? It requires reference to the correct person or the correct title, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, what it says exactly is, shall state the applicant's authority to make such application. The authority to make the application is the order, in my argument, not just whether it's the proper person. It's the effective, active order and not an order that's been repealed.
And Keeney had authority under the new order.
Which was not cited.
All right.
It's a hyper-technical argument.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Goodridge.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Blackington, co-counsel. My name is David Lamont. I represent Sam Cook. There are several issues that are specific to Mr. Cook in this case and myself personally, unfortunately. One was during the course of the trial, there was testimony regarding voice identification that it was made from in-court identifications. Which has been acceptable. I provided evidence in rebuttal that said there was only two appearances rather than four or five as the agent testified to, and there was only about 62 words spoken, of which about 45 were yes or no. Then they called...
The court appearances.
Yes, sir. Which it's troubling in a way that you have to be concerned now that I have to advise my client not to answer the court's questions when he's in court because it may be used as evidence against him. So it's created a very perilous situation. But the detective was called back on rebuttal and said that he listened to myself and my client talk when we were at counsel table. And that also aided in his identification of my client's voice. And at that point, or somewhere in that point, I asked for a mistrial. And my feeling at that time was that I had been made a witness in the trial. I'm a very mild-mannered person who speaks very little and very softly. And at that point, I could not take the stand and testify on my client's behalf to rebut what the agent was saying about what he heard between me and my client at the table. So we believe it's...
But he didn't, as I understand it, the agent didn't testify to the words that were spoken or the conversation. I mean, putting aside the, you know, this technique as a way to identify, I mean, it was not discussed. So in terms of you rebutting something, if you testified, the substance of the conversation never came out, right?
That's correct, but it's not the substance, it's the voice and whether or not the conversation even occurred.
Did you have an opportunity to cross-examine Detective Simpson on exactly how much he was able to hear?
Yes, sir, I did.
And the conversations that he's talking about were at a preliminary hearing in a magistrate judge's courtroom, wasn't it?
Yes.
Fairly small room, I assume.
I believe one of them was the first one, and the second one was in the regular courtroom.
And the tables are relatively close to each other.
Yes, but
there was no order of the judge ordering the government out or anything of that nature.
No.
But so what, your client's expectation of confidentiality seems pretty low in that environment.
That goes to the attorney-client privilege, but not to making myself as a witness in the trial, because I don't talk in courtrooms to my clients. But I tell them that anything they have to say to me, I'll talk to them when I'm in jail.
Are you the only person in the world who could identify his voice or identify that a voice is not his voice?
That's not correct, but I don't think I have any burden to do that. I think the burden is upon the government.
What could you have testified to?
I would have testified to that we did not speak for 15 minutes before the judge came in. We did not talk at all, other than me to tell him that I will talk to him when we're in a jail cell or at the holding facility. I would testify that that's my nature and that's the way I've been doing criminal law for 30 years, or at least the last 25.
And when you made your motion for mistrial, did you give the district court judge that offer of proof? Did you make an offer of proof?
It was not as eloquent as it is now or as detailed, but it was the fact that I said he has now made me a witness in the trial, and obviously I'd never run into such a situation before.
But you didn't say to the court, and if I were not, if I were permitted to testify, I would testify that no words were spoken between me and my client. Did you say that to the judge?
No.
Did you bring that? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Did you bring that up on cross-examination?
No, I didn't.
Thank you. I'll give you one more minute because we did have a lot of questions. Was there anything else you – I know everybody's really on a tight leash here.
Well, there's just two pretty quick issues, but they're really relevant. One is the government holding up a sign saying – there was zero evidence presented by my client to rebut the voice identification, and I think that goes against his right to remain silent, the due process right that he doesn't have to testify, he doesn't have to present any evidence, and there shouldn't be any comments or any statements about that fact that he chose to exercise that right.
Is it common for counsel to hold signs up during closing arguments in that part of the country?
Not for the government, Your Honor. It's the first time I'd seen one that said the defense put on zero evidence.
All right.
And then I had the voice identification issue. And that was basically that 901B5 says you have to have familiarity. The courts have expanded that to say minimal familiarity. But that's not the rules of evidence. And when the court says minimal familiarity, there are also circumstantial evidence that supports that minimal familiarity. And in this case, there was none of that.
By the way, did the government disclose this fellow as an expert in voice identification and give the disclosure that's required in Rule 16?
I don't recall, Judge.
Did you object to it on that basis, that he had not qualified as an expert?
Initially, I objected because the first question out of the government's mouth was, are all these tapes Sam Cooke? So I didn't think the proper foundation had been laid, and so I objected to that. And then later on, as the witness provided more information, I objected on the foundation for presenting the witness, the evidence.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Womack. Mr. Womack?
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Blackington, co-counsel. My name is Dax Womack. It was my pleasure to represent Damon Matthews in this case. The issue that I have addressed for the court, at least with respect to my brief, is issue number 4. Mr. Matthews, in my estimation, was uniquely situated within this conspiracy. As I've set forth in my brief, Mr. Matthews was incarcerated of all but the final month of this conspiracy. He's a resident of Chicago, and it's our position that he was never in Evansville. But nonetheless, the issue that I've asked the court to consider is whether or not Mr. Matthews was entitled to a lesser-included instruction, which we generically refer to as a phone count. The evidence against Mr. Matthews was basically three things in the case. The testimony of Sherita Nesbitt, which in my estimation was exculpatory. If you go to her sworn statement at her change of plea hearing on June 2nd of 08, she states that Mr. Matthews didn't have anything to do with this. That was evidence number one. Number two was a series of phone calls that I believe to be rather innocuous, but I believe there were about eight or nine of them that were admitted. Same situation has previously been presented. Familiarity based upon statements my client had apparently made in a detention hearing where he denied that he was Munchie, who is the person that is identified in these phone calls. And then the third evidence is the one that I guess has been most troubling with me. In the United States' brief, they assert that my client, there was evidence presented at trial that my client was in Evansville selling drugs. Well, my client, again, was incarcerated 8 of the 9 months. The day, I believe it was the last day of trial, a video was shown. And in this video, there is an allegation made by a DEA agent that that was my client in that video. I asked the DEA agent, had there ever been any document prepared or that supported this contention? He said there had. I asked the judge to approach. I said, Judge, I've never received any document that evidences this identification. There was a brief recess. They went and found a DEA 6 form. When I looked at the DEA 6 form, the identification occurred the day before the trial started. So here we have the three pieces of evidence that suggest my client entered into a conspiracy. One is the exculpatory testimony of Sherita Nesbitt, who did actually deliver the drugs to Evansville. She was arrested with such on her person. She says my client had nothing to do with this. The second evidence would be the phone calls from a Munchie, and then the third being this rather spurious identification of my client being in Evansville. Now, my client is screaming at me during the trial he was not in Evansville, that this was another unnamed co-conspirator, and yet the only evidence he could provide to me that he was not in Evansville was that he was meeting his parole officer here. So that's a little troubling for me in trying to introduce that evidence to a jury that he wasn't there because he's in Chicago meeting a parole officer. Nonetheless, Mr. Matthews should have been entitled to this lesser-included instruction of using a communication device while engaging, if you believe that he is in fact Munchie, which he denied under oath at his detention hearing, that he should receive this lesser-included instruction. It's a two-part test. The lesser offense must be included in the greater offense, and the second prong is whether or not a rational jury could acquit him of the greater offense and convict him of the lesser. And I submit to the court that this is not a novel argument. This argument has been made in the Goins case in 1993. And in fact, the government has acquiesced that under these circumstances, it's appropriate that a lesser included be given. Because in the Goins case, in front of the grand jury, they indicted on these lesser included offenses. These defendants were similarly situated to my client. The only evidence in the Goins case to the individuals that received the lesser included was that they engaged in phone conversations about drug dealing. So there is no distinction between them and my client. It is my contention that my client would meet the first prong if you believe that the phone call evidence is the evidence of a conspiracy. And number two, he could have been acquitted of the greater offense had the jury been given the opportunity to consider that. And that's where my concern is with the government's argument that, well, a conspiracy and a phone count are elementally different under Blockberger and the other cases that they've cited. And that's true. They are elementally different, but they need to be viewed within the context of the evidence that was put forth at the trial. And I've gone over with you what the evidence was against my client, those three things. And the only thing that could stick is if a jury believed he is Munchie and he is the one on the phone calls. Therefore, he should be entitled to that lesser included instruction. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Womack. Mr. Blackington?
Good morning. May it please the court. The first issue that I would like to address is the issue of the expired Attorney General's order. Title 18, Section 2518.1a states that in an affidavit, in an application for authority to conduct wire surveillance, the government has to identify the applicants and, in quotes, authority to make such application. In this case, the authority of a deputy assistant attorney general to sign off on a wiretap application and affidavit isn't derived directly from statute. It's derived from the relevant attorney general's order. And in this case, with respect to the third affidavit, and the third affidavit only, an expired attorney general's order was referenced, as we've discussed. And the question is, I think it's pretty clearly a statutory violation because we don't have the right authority indicated in the affidavit and the application. But the question really is suppression an appropriate remedy? And I think the court, in questioning the appellant's counsel, has recognized that the key thing here is that somebody with actual authority to approve a wiretap affidavit did sign off on it and did give authority. And that is really at the crux of the Chavez opinion that I cited in my brief. In that case, the application incorrectly identified the person who granted authority for the application, but the Supreme Court held that that wasn't something that justified suppression because the person, in fact, had authority. And in this case, Deputy Assistant Attorney General Keeney had authority to authorize the application under either the expired order or the new order that hadn't been disseminated through the corridors of the Department of Justice properly. So I think that in this case, since he did have authority, suppression's not warranted because this purpose of the statute and the authorization requirements been met, that a politically accountable figure at the Department of Justice did approve the application.
All right. Can you move to this issue of Cook's conversation with his counsel during the trial? Because I'm troubled by that. Who suggested that he eavesdrop on Cook's conversation with his counsel? How did that come about?
My understanding, and I wasn't present at the initial hearing. I hadn't had the case at that point in time. It wasn't assigned to me. But my understanding in the Detective Simpson's testimony was that both the government personnel, the attorney and Detective Simpson, they were seated at the government's table, and Mr. Lamont was seated at the defense table with his client. And Detective Simpson's testimony was that he overheard them speaking to each other. And having been in the courtroom, especially in Evansville, where the initial appearances occur before the magistrates, if it occurred in that room, and I don't know, there's probably about as much distance between us right now as exists in the courtroom. So I don't think there was an allegation that anybody was improperly eavesdropping. They were sitting at the table. And when it came time to identify the voices, that was the evidence that we had.
Well, how did you get him indicted if you didn't know who the voice was until he spoke in court?
I didn't handle the grand jury proceeding, Your Honor, that led to the indictment, so I'm not entirely sure what evidence was presented to the grand jury at that point.
But you agree that the only evidence linking him to or identifying his voice was the evidence presented by the agent?
At trial?
At trial.
The evidence that was presented by the agent was the primary evidence that was introduced.
What else was
that? Correct.
What else was to link him to this conspiracy other than the voice identification?
I don't recall anything else, Your Honor, off the top of
pretty,
my head.
Pretty thin.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then when we look at the standard for admissibility, minimum familiarity was sufficient is sufficient for admissibility purposes. What about counsel's argument that in these other cases there's a little more besides a minimal identification?
I don't think that's the case. And the appellant's initial brief, they cited Harvey for the proposition that clear and convincing evidence was required. Harvey didn't implicate Rule 901b-5. It involved the authentication of physical evidence from a campsite. It didn't contain the quote that counsel for appellants attributed to it. In the second brief, the reply brief that the appellants filed, and I may butcher the name of the court case, they cited the Farratt case. That case was reversed by this court in United States versus Westmoreland, which was cited at 312 F3rd 302, the pinpoint site's 310. Now, in the Westmoreland case, there is some language in there about clear and convincing evidence, but neither Farratt or Westmoreland apply to voice identification issues. Those cases center around the admission of the tape and whether the tape itself is an accurate recording, not voice identification, but whether that's an accurate recording. So that being the case, those cases don't even apply to the issue of voice identification.
Have we approved any case, though, where there's been so little evidence of familiarity with the voice?
I think so. Most of the Resendez case and others talk about if a police officer has the ability to hear the defendant's voice under any type of situation, it's been found sufficient.
And what were the facts in that case?
There was an interview, a brief interview conducted between the police officer and the defendant.
Right,
at
so
the
that
time
was a one-on-one
arrest.
Conversation, not our situation where there was there's listening at the arraignment, but then during the course of the trial, when he's with his counsel, there's that overhears. Well, what's another case that, what's the factual, because this is very...
There isn't another case where a person's being identified based upon overhearing someone speaking to counsel at in a court proceeding. But what I think's important isn't, did this happen in court? Did this happen in the street? It's, did the person have the ability to hear the voice? And did the person have the ability to see the speaker at the time they were speaking? So to me, we deal with three different issues here. There's the attorney-client privilege issue. There's the sufficiency of the voice identification. And the testimony was that the officer heard him speaking to his lawyer for 10 or 15 minutes, and he was in a position to see him. So I think that's sufficient. It doesn't matter if it happens in court or someone speaking out on the street.
Of course,
my voice
didn't have that until rebuttal, right? Testimony. In your direct testimony, he only testified about having heard him speak in court on those occasions, which was 45 words or 60 words, something like that.
He didn't say he only heard him speak in court during the course of the hearing, and perhaps the difficulty there was
Can you just make a distinction between what he said on direct exam versus his examination as a rebuttal witness? That would be helpful.
Yes. What he said on direct during examination was in response to probably my poor questioning. Under what circumstances did you hear him speak? I heard him speak in court. I didn't distinguish between, did you hear him answer in response to a judge's questions, or did you hear him speak to his lawyer before the hearing? I didn't flush that out. And when the rebuttal testimony was responded, I found it important to go back and clear up maybe my less than stellar questioning and flesh out exactly what it was that Detective Simpson heard and under what circumstances.
Correct. All he had heard was what he said at the arraignment in response to the judge's questions, right?
No, the questioning was in court. I didn't go.
And then on cross-examination, defense counsel brought out, well, he was only in court these couple of times, and he only said certain words, right?
Yeah, under in the hearing,
and
during
the proceedings. And then he actually produced transcripts of those hearings.
Exactly.
And then you called the same agent as a rebuttal witness in your rebuttal case.
Yes.
And brought out the attorney conversation.
Yes, precisely. So my questioning wasn't maybe as precise as it should have been, and I didn't anticipate the line of questioning. Well, you know, what you know was said in response to a judge's questioning. So that being the case, does the court...
I just assume there was no one else the government could have called to identify the voice, and there was no sort of voice identification
Yeah, like I said, I inherited the case, and it was a problematic issue for me, and it's not my personal preference to command somebody to give a voice exemplar, because in my experience, those are less reliable than what an officer would hear, because when somebody comes before the grand jury or in court to give a voice exemplar, they darn well know why they're in there. And
well,
they
we sure don't want to encourage agents to listen in to communications between their a defendant and his lawyer. That's really troubling.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. But if they're
and the guy faces a life sentence, mm-hmm. it seems to me that what's the harm in compelling him to give a voice exemplar if you're facing if the stakes are that high?
Again, I just don't think they're accurate because it gives a defendant a very good. They understand why they're in there, and
so there's more accuracy in overhearing conversations between a lawyer and client. That's trouble.
Well, there are two different issues, and I'd say that going back to the issue that really troubles the court, I shouldn't be presumptuous enough to see what the court is. I think the issue that troubles the court here isn't necessarily the 15 minutes or 10 minutes he overheard the conversation. It's really the attorney-client privilege issue. And again, in this situation, there wasn't a confidential communication. They're sitting in court. There's no expectation of, or very little expectation of privacy in that situation, especially if they're speaking loudly enough that Detective Simpson could hear them.
Well, there's sure no expectation you're going to make your case mm-hmm. based on what they're talking about, or how they talk about it, basically. There's no expectation of that.
Certainly, but that's different from an expectation of privacy that should be warranted. And the other thing is there was nothing introduced purposely about the content of their communication. So I think that the way that we really have to analyze this is to dice it up into the three separate issues and ask, number one, was the attorney-client privilege implicated in this case? And the answer is no, because they're speaking loudly enough that a witness in court who's sitting at the proper table can hear them, and also that the content of their communication is not being disclosed in court. And the question is sufficiency of the evidence. He's sitting in there for 10 or 15 minutes letting him speak with his lawyer. And I understand Mr. Lamont said it didn't happen that way. I'm not questioning Mr. Lamont's integrity at all. I was not there, but that's not what the record indicates happened.
Did Simpson share with you what the content of their conversation was?
He did not, and I purposely did not ask him, because I did not want to be a party to any type of advantage that would be gained by possibly getting insight into a defense lawyer's tactics.
He was a case agent, wasn't he, Simpson?
He was a co-case agent.
So he was in court with you, and he was able to watch the trial and how things went.
He was not in court during the trial. The DEA agent was. They only allowed me to permit, only permitted me to have one agent there in trial.
And you don't know if he had any conversations with the DEA agent that might have had some impact on the case. I'm just worried about
during the trial.
Yeah, I'm worried about the, as Judge Tinder is, you know, allowing this kind of communication, because there are many ways that one might be able to influence a case. So I understand you said, I don't want to know anything about what was said. But, you know, what did Simpson say to the DEA agent? If anything, it starts us down that long road.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that part of the issue is that, you know, there should not be a situation where defense lawyers and their counsel are speaking in open court about strategic issues with the government sitting over there. I'm not saying they were. I don't know if they were talking about strategic issues or, you know, how the Colts looked for the upcoming season. I don't know what the content of their communication was, and I didn't inquire into it, frankly, and it wasn't brought out in court, so I do not believe that there was a violation of the attorney-client privilege in this case. So, if anybody, if nobody has any further questions about that issue, I'd like to move on to some other things. Okay. The next issue that I'd like to discuss concerns the admission of Lamont Robinson's statement during the change of plea hearing. And I'd like to correct Mr. Foster's statement. The question that was asked of Lamont Robinson during the plea hearing was whether he delivered to Leonard Hoskins and Mitchell McGee. And the sections of the transcript that I'd specifically cite are page 1060, lines 6 through 9, and page 1062, lines 18 through 20. The other thing that I'd like to correct is I never said it's not hearsay. I simply, the court asked me, the court said, well, I think he might be available, and I didn't want to let the court make a ruling on a fact that didn't exist. And I said my position was he was not available because his lawyer said he'd assert the Fifth. So I didn't say it was not hearsay. I merely said the witness would be unavailable. And also it wasn't our position that he was an enforcer or a second in command. Our position was that he was a drug runner. And the wiretap showed that he ran drugs to other charged conspirators. There was nothing indicated that he ever delivered cocaine to Leonard Hoskins and Mitchell McGee. So I think it was not relevant. It was hearsay, and the former testimony exception to the hearsay rule wouldn't apply in this case because in a change of plea hearing, the government doesn't have the need to examine him about who he's dealing with, the issues, whether there's a factual basis. With respect to the denial of a lesser included offense instruction, the test is an elements test, as McCulloch states. The appellant seemed to believe it's a transactional test. That's not what this court said in the McCulloch case. That's not what the Goins case says. The Goins case does not stand for the proposition that use of a communications device is a lesser included offense of conspiracy. I'm having difficulty figuring what the appellants think Goins stands for, because it was a 48-page opinion and there wasn't a pinpoint site. But the only two issues that I flushed out in Goins that may even apply to this case is, first, this court held that illegal purchase of a weapons is not a lesser included offense of a drug conspiracy. Maybe that's the issue. And secondly, in that case, at the indictment stage, the government indicted the defendants for both conspiracy and, with some of the defendants, use of a communications device. So this is a case where there wasn't a request for use of a communications device as a lesser included offense that was granted. This was a case where it was charged in the indictment stage. So Goins has absolutely nothing to do with this case. It certainly doesn't stand for the proposition that use of a communications device is a lesser included offense of conspiracy, because there's a separate element that the alleged lesser included offense has that isn't contained within conspiracy, and that's use of a telephone. Proceeding to the issue, my statement about whether the uncontroverted nature of the voice identification testimony. First of all, I did not hold up a big sign like Vanna White and walk around with a zero on it. I had a PowerPoint instruction or a PowerPoint presentation as part of my closing, had about 50 PowerPoint slides. One of them said zero. And in this case, it's only a violation of the self-incrimination provisions of the Constitution if there's no other witness that can provide the evidence about voice identification. Certainly, unless these witnesses were mutes, and there's no evidence of that, they've spoken to other people in the past, parents, friends, probation officers, whatever. There are many other people who could either identify their voice or exclude another voice from being that person's voice. So there were other individuals available to present their testimony, so it wasn't a comment on their right to remain silent. Now, in the rebuttal brief, the appellants take a different position. They move away from the idea that it's self-incrimination, and they say for the first time in their rebuttal brief that it's improper burden shifting. Of course, I think they waived this issue in their rebuttal brief because that's the first time they raise it. But if they don't, I would note that there's a case, United States versus Butler, which this court ruled on 71 F3rd 243, the pinpoint's 255 note 8, which says, you know, basically when there's an allegation of improper burden shifting, the prosecutor's allowed to argue inferences based on the absence of evidence unless the comments draw adverse influence to the person's right to testify. So even under a burden shifting argument, we're back to the position, you know, where we're questioning whether there is a self-incrimination issue. The other issue is just to proceed.
Well, with respect to the verdict form, representation was made that an alternative request for a multiple conspiracy instruction was made. Is that correct?
I don't think so, but I'm not going to indicate that with 100% certainty. I'd ask, and I could certainly look at the transcript if the court wanted me to, but in any event, you know, we're not up here. That issue wasn't raised, and that was argued for the first time here in front of the court, that the defendants intended to argue maybe that there were multiple conspiracies. Just running through the other issues, Mitchell McGee's first issue was concerning the intoxication issue and whether it rendered his confession involuntary. The court's finding was that there was no evidence to support the belief that he was intoxicated, and also Mr. McGee's counsel even admitted that there was no evidence of police coercion, which you have to find a statement involuntary. Secondly, with respect to Mr. McGee's confession, there was a Miranda issue, and the issue was not whether there were warnings given, because there weren't, but whether he was subjected to a custodial interrogation. The court's findings were that Mr. McGee was not subjected to interrogation because he initiated the conversation. The police did not question him. He wanted to cooperate with the police and volunteered the information, so it wasn't an interrogation. With respect to the issue of whether there was probable cause to support the wiretap, if the court thinks that the neighbor's evidence should not have been included in the affidavit, that's fine. It's always, you look prospectively and say, well, there was no connection. That's not always apparent when you start the investigation. The proper thing to do is just redact all of the references to neighbors, and what you're left with are controlled buys where drugs were bought and Mr. Simmons's phone, which was tapped, was used to facilitate the drug deal. With respect to the individual findings of drug quantity, I think Seymour's right on point, and I took particular caution in this case because I submitted essentially the same verdict form that this court approved in Seymour to the district court in this case. Lastly, the issue of whether the sentences of life imprisonment violated the Eighth Amendment, I think that position's been rejected. And if the court had, I see my time is enough. I just wanted to, if I could have the indulgence of the court, I wanted to check a factual question the court asked me about the Cook voice identification.
All right.
The only thing I'd want to add to my discussion about that, there were some other witnesses that were, there were independent voice identifications. He's not one of them. I wanted to check that. I did want to cite the Mansouri case, which is cited in my brief. And in that case, an agent did hear someone speak during the course of a court proceeding. And that was found sufficient to identify his voice.
Counsel, your opponents cite cases that say, with respect to the Cook problem and the admission of his voice identification, that before the tape is admitted, there must be clear and convincing evidence. And that, yet we've been talking about minimal familiarity of the identifier. How do you reconcile the use of those two standards in the same analysis?
Well, very easily, the clear and convincing evidence standard's never been used in a voice identification context. In the initial brief, the appellant cited Harvey for that proposition, included a quote. That quote doesn't exist in the Harvey opinion. The Harvey opinion involves the authentication of physical evidence from a campsite, has nothing to do with voice identification. In the response brief, appellants, honestly, they made a mistake citing that case, obviously. They cited Farote, which was reversed by Westmoreland. And both Farote and in Westmoreland, there's some language about clear and convincing evidence being a standard for the admissibility of evidence. But the admissibility of evidence that they're talking about in Westmoreland and Farote, for that matter, isn't voice identification evidence. The issue that this court raised was the admission of a tape, physically a tape, and it has that tape been properly authenticated? It's not a voice identification issue. It's, you know, was the tape created properly? Did chain of custody exist? That type of issue, not voice identification. So there's no contradiction between the cases at all.
Thank you, Mr. Blackington.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Lamont.
I'd like to take just a brief moment to go through some of the issues that some of my co-counsel had asked me to reply to. One is it's the position that on the order signed or the order that was outdated, that that's more analogous to the Giordani case and not the Chavez case as the government provides here today. Chavez, they had the wrong official, but it was the Attorney General who signed the order, and we don't have the Attorney General signing this order. There was some questions and concerns about the difference between the admission of the tape and the admission of voice identification. And I did incorrectly cite the wrong case in the first brief, but I corrected that in the reply brief. And it says, by clear and convincing evidence that the tape is a true, accurate, and authentic recording of the conversation at a given time between the parties involved. Clear and convincing that it's between the parties involved. And there's nothing in this case to show that it was involving Sam Cook. I find it a little disturbing that a voice exemplar is not as good as somebody listening to him in court. Detective Simpson, in the course of this trial, admitted he'd made mistakes on some other defendants' telephone conversations. And so I don't think that's correct. I think also if the court would read the transcript of my client's testimony at the initial hearing versus listening to his vernacular on the tapes, they wouldn't believe it was the same person talking. So to say that somebody talking in a exemplar is going to make up their voice is just not accurate, because if you listen to those, you can tell the vernacular is totally different. And the it was mentioned that we did not object to the burden shifting, and I believe Mr. Friesen made that objection in the transcript. He objected to the government trying to shift the burden by holding up the zero. And it seems to me that the government's off base by saying they do not. They can say anytime they want to that the defendant has not presented any evidence, zero evidence, because the burden is never on the defendant. And the law is quite clear for many years that the defendant does not have to testify, he does not have to present any evidence, and the fact that he does so should not be commented upon. Mr. Womack wanted me to mention on behalf of Mr. Matthews, that there's nothing in the record regarding his voice identification other than the agent at the time he was in the initial hearing denying that the voice was his and denying that he was Munchie. And there is on in our appendix, pages 305 and 306, a motion for a multiple conspiracy construction and discussion about that. So we would ask the court to reverse the convictions and set all the cases for new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. And we thank counsel. You were all appointed for your diligence and your hard work and fine representation of your clients. And we thank you, Mr. Blackington, for your fine representation of the government. The case will be taken under advisement.